Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. Not the live version of a version of Waltz for Debbie. There are so many. And that one chosen tonight by tonight's guest, because on Sundays we get someone to pick the music. And tonight the music is being picked by Mark Doherty, who is a writer and an actor and all manner of things. In fact, you've been in what they call a heap of things, I guess, is how you'd put it, Mark.
Yeah, I don't know what I am. I don't know, when people ask, I don't know how to describe what I do at all. I'm a bit of a chancer who gets away with fingers in a number of pies.
Well, for the purpose of tonight's interview and making it sound rather more streamlined than you've just presented yourself, Tuesday night your play, which you wrote, Trad, opens in Cork, and that's been on the go for the past while now. Aaron Monaghan, who was our guest a while back on the show, directed it.
Yeah.
But that's an old play, isn't it?
It was produced in 2004 originally. Yeah, I wrote it over the course of a couple of years, and it became what it became. And then I managed to get it to a sympathetic producer, Rose Parkinson, at the Galway Arts Festival, and she really dug it, so she wanted to put it on. So that was the start of it, yeah.
Well, Mark, we'll no doubt come back to many of the things you've just mentioned as we progress through the evening picking your tunes, but just that first tune you picked, Waltz for Debbie.
Yeah.
It's not a version of it that I know, although there are numerous versions of it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you heard first. I'm guessing, given the fact that, well, you should say this at the start, your dad, Jim Doherty, very well known, Irish jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing the Bill Evans version was floating in the air around your house, was it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I ever heard my dad playing that tune. I know Louis Stewart used to play it a lot, but I've always loved it. It's got a nice lyric as well. In this version, it's called Monica's Waltz, which I presume is Monica Zetterlund sang it also with Bill Evans. They might have even had some kind of romantic liaison, I think. But I'm a big fan of, I love singing. I love the human voice, John, the human voice. And I love harmony. And, you know, this is only five singers there singing that. And it sounds like a very full band and full orchestration.
You've got quite a few singers on your list.
I do, yeah. I think I chose about half and half. I love the human voice, yeah. But that one, yeah, I just think it's a lovely noise they make. There's only five of them, and yet they create this swinging thing that starts in a waltz time and then goes into 4-4. And there's very little wrong with that, I think.
Well, look, let's have your second choice, and then we'll talk about your dad and the musical background in your house.
Yeah.
And this what you've chosen is your dad with Louis Stewart. Now tell me. Now I've seen Louis play. God rest him. And I saw your dad play. You know, and a lot of their contemporaries over the years. What did that whole scene mean to you as a kid growing up? You know, because there weren't. I mean, there may have been, but there weren't many jazz musicians with a name in Ireland. I don't think whose names were known.
No. Yeah, I think I don't know when I became aware of it, that my family was a tiny bit different to the other families. Like, I went to a nice school, St. Michael's College, and better known for rugby now more than anything. But it's where a lot of professional people would have sent their children. You know, a lot of doctors and dentists and lawyers probably came out of there. But I remember about the age of 12 or 13, I became aware that my upbringing was a tiny bit different, or my family situation. I suppose the house was full of musicians all the time, but I didn't assume that other houses weren't full of musicians as well, you know. I remember a teacher asking us one time about parent-teacher meetings. My father could never attend these things. And I remember a teacher saying something about all of us being so lucky because our fathers, our mothers and fathers are there every night and our fathers go to work in the morning. I remember sticking my hand up going, no. My dad is usually gigging at night and then he doesn't get up. And I see him when I come home from school at 4 o'clock and he's in his pyjamas sometimes writing, you know. So it was a slightly different upbringing maybe, but I didn't know anything else. It was great.
Well, let's listen to your dad, Jim Doherty, with Louis Stewart and This Can't Be Love. This Can't Be Love, that version from Jim Doherty and Louis Stewart together, and Mark Doherty, Jim's son, is my guest tonight, picking all the music. Actually, just clear this one up for me, Mark. You're Mark Doherty, your dad's Jim Doherty, but your brother is Mark O'Doherty.
Yeah, David O'Doherty.
Or sorry, David O'Doherty. Yeah, your brother's not Mark. That would be funny.
Just show but a curious lack of imagination on my parents.
He's David O'Doherty.
Yeah.
Has he picked a stage name, or have you and your dad picked a stage name?
I don't know if I should tell the truth about this because there's various versions of it out there, right. And I like hearing what people think is the truth about it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you.
My dad, I believe, was advised to drop the O. We are officially O'Doherty.
All right, okay.
So he was playing under the name Jim O'Doherty or James O'Doherty. I think somebody advised him that there was a better flow, Jim O'Doherty. Okay. Sounded better.
Yeah.
So then, because he had quite a high profile when we were growing up, it was assumed that we were Doherty.
Of course, yeah.
So I just went along with that. So in the first show I ever did, I was put in the program as Mark Doherty. I wasn't asked what my name was, so I went with that. So David is actually the only one telling the truth. The name is O'Doherty.
Fair enough.
But I've read versions on the internet that David mysteriously planted an O in his name to differentiate himself from his jazz playing father and his brother and all this. So there's the truth for once.
Well, let's go back to that house then. Where were you living?
We grew up in Sandymount.
Sandymount,
yeah,
right.
Church. Born in Churchtown, and then moved to Sandymount.
And I normally ask people this question, but in your case, it's obviously true. A piano in the house, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They got good use out of it. Yeah,
they did. And was your dad playing piano like all the time?
No, he wasn't playing all the time. No, I mean. I think back in those days when, the early 70s, there were a lot of gigs. So he was gigging, he was away a lot and he was playing 6 nights a week a lot of the time. Not just jazz now either. Mm. He would call himself a musician rather than necessarily a jazz musician, I think. But it's just he is such a talent, but a head for music. And he just hears something and plays it and... So improvisation is one of his great skills and talents. But I think, he's done a lot of musical theatre, written for jingles for ads and theme music for television shows and shows that a lot of us grew up with. Wanderly Wagon and all these things. Mm. My Sundays when I was growing up were spent in Studio One in RTE watching the recording of Wanderly Wagon.
Great.
Yeah, Eugene Lambert and. Standing in front of a bit of green screen with Judge. And
while all that is brilliant, I would imagine, though, I can't speak for your dad, but I can imagine playing with Louis Stewart in that circumstance is probably the best of all, was it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
They went back a long way.
They did, yeah, yeah. I think my dad claims he gave Louis his first gig and possibly this album, Tunes, we just heard, This Can't Be Love. I think that might have been Louis' last recording. So they had this professional and personal association for like 50 years, more than that. There's a story about the album Tunes that 50 years ago they said we must do an album of duets, and they finally got around to it. But Louis, yeah, I often wonder, did everybody know how good Louis was? At the time, I think I heard my dad saying, well, he just assumed all guitarists were as good as this. If this was a kid from Waterford and he could do this, then, you know, there were. But I think it was only, only a little later you realised this is such a special talent and such a unique and brilliant gift and facility that this fellow
had. Such an interesting character, Louis, the way he would kind of, not underplay it, but he wouldn't make a big deal out of it, you know? I just know from doing radio and so on, you would constantly meet these Louis fans, you know, who would say, why don't you do more for Louis and why don't you play more Louis?
Yeah.
But Louis wasn't in any way pushy about things. You know, he wasn't sitting there moaning that he wasn't a big star. His fans were.
Yeah,
Fans are really annoyed that Louis wasn't getting the attention he deserved.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's no doubt, I mean, if he had lived in New York or somewhere, he'd be as well known as Jim Hall or any of the rest of them.
Yeah, and he is, you know, among musicians and diehard fans. He is that well known, but his neighbours wouldn't have known him, probably, you know.
Yeah. I know when I first went to New York and met jazz musicians and they said, where are you from? And I'd say Ireland, all of them would say, do you know Louis Stewart?
Yeah.
You know, they would always, Tommy Flanagan, people like that, do you know
really,
Louis
Stewart?
Yeah,
I've heard of a lot of musicians coming in here. The first thing they would do if they were coming in to play a concert, the first thing they would do is get Louis's number and go and hang out with him that afternoon or play with him or something. And this is a guitarist like, guys like Pat Martino and, John Scofield and people like this. Guys, you know, John Scofield playing with Miles Davis gets to Dublin and goes, get me Louis Stewart.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
So... when you're in a house like that, now, I mean, it wasn't exclusively a jazz household. But I mean, given that your father was working and all, he was a working musician, so he was having to play everything.
Yeah.
Was he listening to everything as well in the house? I mean, I know other people who worked in either show bands or big bands or orchestras and so on, and they had to keep on top of all kinds of music for professional reasons. Mm-hmm. So people like Elvis Costello, for instance, because his dad was in the Joe Loss Band, he was hearing everything from Ella Fitzgerald to the Beatles to, you know, all these songs were being played by his dad professionally.
Yeah.
So he, you know, there was so much music in the house.
Yeah.
Your list suggests perhaps you were just listening to jazz your entire life.
Well, I don't know. I had difficulty making this list because I was trying to think of what music I listened to and what music that was important to me at particular times. But I just don't listen to it anymore. It doesn't mean anything to me, you know. At one stage, I was...
You don't listen to music anymore?
Oh, no, I do. I do. But it's become quite... Not exclusively this music, but the music that I might have had time for when I was 13, I really don't care about at all anymore.
Yeah.
Like, the last single I bought, I think, was by The Smiths.
Yeah.
What Difference Does It Make? That was a very important piece of music. But really... 2 years later, I didn't care. I was listening to Queen, and I liked a melody. And but that music, I was going to put bits, you know, a track or two of that down for this show, but I didn't want to in the end because there's so much great music that I listen to now.
Mm.
So I've
no, I understand that.
Yeah, I focused it.
You mentioned singers earlier on. Your next choice is a singer. Again, you know, she's not as well known as some of the others. I mean, she's not as well known as Ella or Sarah Vaughan or something.
This is
like
Irene Cranach.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, she's not well known at all. In fact, I think she died very young. I think she died of cancer at the age of 40-something, early 40s. But there's a beautiful, there's a purity about her voice. She sings in tune. And she sings, she has a jazz feel. I love the way she phrases a lyric. She kind of makes it her own. And she plays... she plays with this beautiful pianist, Alan Broadbent, this New Zealand fellow. Do you know him?
He played with Charlie Hayden a lot, that guy.
Yes, he did. Yeah, of course. Yeah. He's great. I think he's still around. But this is a song that they recorded. And it's a little piece I came across. It's a Dave Frischberg song. And Dave Frischberg I don't know if you know him, but he kind of continued the great tradition of the great writers and lyricists, the Tin Pan Alley guys, you know, and he brought it a step further.
And as a matter of interest, would you have heard this when you were growing up, or did you come to it in later life?
I had a cassette of it, I remember. Yeah. I don't know where it came from. And it was these quirky, wry little songs, and this one was on it. But this is a very... my love of lyrics, this is a deceptively simple... But quite brilliant song, like a good poem where there's something else going on in the background, you know.
Okay. You Are There, Irene Crowell.
In the evening, the kettle's on for tea. An old familiar feeling settles over me, and it's your face.
Well, Mark, that's a beaut. Mark Doherty in studio with me tonight, picking all the music, and that's Irene Crowell. It's gorgeous, that, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That was a song called You Are There by Dave Frischberg, yeah.
From an album called The Gentle Rain.
He's a great writer, Dave Frischberg, yeah. He was kind of adopted by a few singers. Blossom Dearie recorded a lot of his stuff, and songs like I think he put the words to "Peel Me a Grape," "My Attorney Bernie," the underdog. What's the one I wrote down? A lyric from the underdog. Oh yeah, people think it's funny when you're spending all your money on the clown when the chips are down. These are the, just beautiful little rhymes. You would rather have the blues. Do you know that song? Dollar bills could float down from the sky. You could be the world's most lucky guy. Any guy with half a chance to choose would choose to be in your shoes. But still, you'd lose, because you would rather have the blues. Yeah, I think we all know somebody like that, you know?
And then the other aspect of this too, which I guess probably interests you as an actor, is that these songs are sung and put across to you by the middle man or woman, the mm-hmm. singer. Mm-hmm. You know, so you mentioned Blossom Dearie, and you know, there's Irene Crowell there singing that song. Mm. They're not even singing their own words, and they can do that, you know. And that's, of course, what an actor has to do.
Yeah, they're interpreters, yeah. But it's more than it's quite a deep gift, I think, to see a song and read it and make it your own and carry it across and, you know, make people believe that that's your story. A lot of the singers that I love aren't even technically the most brilliant singers. They're people who get the feeling across and inhabit a lyric to the extent that you believe it's them and it's their experience that they're singing about. I mean, I love great singers who sing in perfect pitch and with a huge range and acrobatics, and you know, Sarah Vaughan and these guys. But I also love, or maybe even prefer, the likes of Shirley Horn. Mm-hmm. People like that. She's not a brilliant singer, but she absolutely inhabits a song and makes it her own and communicates a message. And you do believe that that she's written it herself and she's lived through these things, you know.
How much of your taste when it comes to jazz do you think came from your dad? I mean, was there any indoctrination going on?
Tonight, children,
we're going to listen to you.
Not at all, no. I remember a few moments where I came to it and started actively listening. I remember one night, whatever age I was, maybe I was 13 or 14, and I remember there was a party on. I think it might have been the end of some theatre show that my dad was involved in, and he was throwing a party, and he asked me to take out some music, have some music ready to play when people come in. And I remember taking out a few records, and I found the Louis Stewart record out on his own. And I knew Louis from hanging around the house and everything, but I'd never listened to the music or considered it even. But I remember actively listening to it that day and finding something beautiful in it. And I remember also, I was listening to Steely Dan, and a few, you know, there was a jazz thing there besides what was going on in my own house. But Steely Dan were playing quite sophisticated rock music, but with jazz influences, and they were bringing in the great jazzers to come for an afternoon to come in and play on a song. And Asia is full of, you know, Wayne Shorter and all these guys. So I remember finding names on album covers and then going to investigate them myself. Mm. I remember one time as well. I think it was a lonely life. It was a lonely time, because I didn't know anybody who had these musical interests. There was one guy in school, a friend of mine, David Handy, who I'm still mates with, but he was into all that as well. However, he found it. His dad was a butcher. Mm. I found it because my dad was a musician, maybe. But I remember in Suffolk Street one day, McCullough Pigott's. Do you remember McCullough Pigott's? I remember there was a vinyl sale on there, and everything was half price or less. And I remember going in there and investigating a few names that I'd come across in Steely Dan records, I think. And I found some Blue Note records. And one of the first ones I bought was The Sidewinder by Lee Morgan.
Yeah.
I think just because I liked the cover, I don't think I would have been familiar with Joe Henderson or Barry Harris or the musicians on it. But I remember taking that home and loving it. And then going back to McCullough Pigott's and investigating further and coming home with more Blue Note records. But it was kind of, it was nothing imposed at all by the Da. I think he was secretly happy that this stuff was...
Will we play it? The Sidewinder?
Yeah.
Oh, which track do you want?
Oh, sorry, I think it's called Boy What a Night. Any of them, it doesn't really matter.
Okay, here's Boy What a Night. Lee Morgan from The Sidewinder. Boy, What a Night from Lee Morgan from the Sidewinder album. And Mark Doherty with me tonight picking the track. So you bought that one in McCullough Pigott's and brought it home and it blew your mind.
Yeah, it did, yeah. It was a lot of that, the Blue Note music around that time was great, kind of early, mid, late 60s even. Pretty catchy tunes as well.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a funk element.
And everything about it was seductive. I mean, the album covers were gorgeous.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that.
Yeah, the guys were...
It presented a kind of a world you wouldn't have minded going off and living in.
Yeah, yeah. Although plenty of them didn't survive it.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that's show business.
You know? Heroin played a big part.
Exactly, yeah.
The film, they called him Morgan.
It's worth seeing.
Yeah, on Lee Morgan's life, yeah.
Now, tell me about your own creative journey as such. Because during that we were talking about how raggedy people's journeys tend to be, you know. Mm. When you were at school, say, did you have an idea in your head what you might like to do when you grew up?
No.
No. No. No notion.
No. I liked the word marketing. I didn't know what it meant, really.
Yeah.
So I didn't pursue that one and I never looked it up. So, I ended up, I went to college, but I think in retrospect, that was only because it was kind of expected that, you know, you go to a nice school, and I got a half-decent Leaving Cert. So I went to college because that's what we all did. Mm. But I really didn't want to be there particularly. I went to Trinity and I studied history of art, which I did like, and Italian, because I had to choose another subject with history of art. And but I was there for, I survived for 2 years in Trinity. I didn't want to be there at all. And then I remember I failed one of my Italian exams and I went to Italy for the summer and I was going to retake the exam, but I never came home. Ended up staying there.
Really?
Yeah. Stayed there for a year and I taught English. And at least I think this is the order. And this is all 30 years ago. Do you get that? I'm putting a nice order on it now because it sounds smooth, but I think this was the order, yeah. So I stayed in Italy and...
In retrospect, you know, and I'm not advising people to abandon university or anything, but in retrospect, might have been the best thing you ever did, I guess. Going to Italy and staying there for a year. I'd done that.
Yeah, well, we don't know. I mean, you end up where you end up, but maybe you might have ended up there anyway, even had you taken a more circuitous route, you know, I don't know. I love offering advice to young, like 14, 15-year-old kids who haven't a notion what they want to do, but I love telling them it doesn't matter. You'll find what you want to do. I think I was 22 before I decided I'd give acting a go.
And what prompted that?
I was in the Stag's Head pub and a friend of mine, Mandy, Amanda Hogan, was directing a play in Trinity. She was doing drama in Trinity and there was a script on the table and I'd had several pints and I had a look at the script and thought, I could give this an audition. I could do that. And she did. And so she gave me a part in it. And I played, a play by Edward Bond called Red, Black and Ignorant. And so she gave me a part in that and we performed it in the old Lombard Street studio that used to belong to Trinity. And that was it. I got such a high from that, such a kick from it that I thought, this is the first thing I've come across that I'd love to do.
And any previous experience at all?
No, none, no. Never in a school play or never any interest or anything, no. But when you're that age as well, like I was playing a bit of guitar and I thought maybe I might play guitar. And I went to Paris and I had a friend in Paris and I went and stayed with him and brought me a guitar and, you know, spent 4 months there busking and meet musicians and playing guitar. I think I realised that I wasn't good enough then to do it or to play the music I wanted. But when you're 21 or 22...
There's no rush.
Yeah, yeah.
And so after you said you got a real high from the performance.
Mm.
You got a real kick out of it. I suppose you couldn't wait to do something else, but it's not that easy when you're an actor, is it? I mean, you
no.
I mean, roles don't necessarily fall at your feet.
No, they don't. No, no. I remember announcing it at home that I'd like to pursue this, and my folks were very generous, and I remember my dad sent me, he said, I know who you have to talk to if you want to do this. I was thinking maybe I could do a course or there's something in Trinity and there's something in, I don't think the Gaiety School was there, but there was a few courses going. And my dad said, I know who you need to talk to. And he sent me down to Ryan's in Sandymount to have a pint with Pat Laffin, recently deceased.
Yeah.
Legendary fella. And we, so I met Pat, and Pat said, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. That's that. You know, so that was I took that as encouragement. So then I found this course in Bull Alley. So I did a 2-year acting course there and then came out and gave it a shot. Yeah.
And what was the first kind of post-college, you know, for want of a better word, proper gig that you had then on stage?
Oh, God. We did, a few of us did this production of Accidental Death of an Anarchist. The few guys that are still performing now were part of it. Jimmy Fay was in it. He's now in the Lyric in Belfast. That was one where we all committed to it, yeah, and then went on the road and played in these... We played in the International in Dublin. Then we played in a place called the Fisherman's Hall in Dunmore East. It was very exciting. For a door split, you know, everybody coming home with 16 quid. That was it, but very exciting. But you have no plan or responsibilities or anything. You just have to make your 20 quid a week rent, you know. So, it was a very exciting period, yeah.
Your next musical choice, and this isn't jazz. We have Martin Hayes on the list.
Martin Hayes, yeah, yeah. Again, I found myself with a cassette of Martin Hayes. I think my dad might have given it to me even. Brian Dunning or somebody would have put him wide to Martin Hayes. Because I don't have any great appreciation of this music or knowledge of the trad scene. But when I heard Martin Hayes, the hair stood up in the back of my neck. I heard Irish traditional tunes and stuff, but with such a feel and such a lilt. And he's bending notes and he's playing the blues. Mm-hmm. And he's got such great technical ability that it's kind of a bit like Louis Stewart. It's just a case of your ideas. What are your ideas now for this bit, you know? But he has this association with Dennis Cahill, and they play together, and they read each other's minds. You know, they're so attuned to each other.
And it's strange not strange at all actually, but that association of the two of them playing together, it appeals to musicians from other disciplines, other genres.
Yeah.
You know, jazz musicians like what they do. You know, people like Billy Frizzell loves what they do.
That's right, yeah, know? Yeah. Well, again, I think they're brilliant musicians without labelling them with as Irish or trad or whatever. They're guys with huge ears who can pick up and communicate with.
Anybody walks into my studio and talks about people with huge ears, there's no need for that. That was a bit strong.
This is actually...
I won't recover from that now.
This is actually with I remember Louis used to always refer to teachers, music teachers, and my dad as well. My dad says, "Oh yeah, sure, his ears are painted on." I think this one is actually is it Steve Cooney? I think on guitar here, but like Dennis Cahill, I've tried playing guitar as well, and I was clearly no good. But these guys, they just play. They use the whole guitar, the whole arm. Beautiful little 2 and 3 note chords, and colour the music in quite a profound way behind the soloist.
So this comes from an album called Under the Moon, Martin Hayes. Martin Hayes there, and a bit of a medley involving O'Connell's March, Galway Bay Hornpipe, The Banshees, Wail, Over the Mangled Pit. Tunes from Martin Hayes there. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. Mark Doherty is with me tonight picking the tracks. And after this break, we're going to talk a little bit more about his current play, which he has written, which has been on tour for the past while and opens in Cork on Tuesday night. It's called Trad. We'll talk about that after this break. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special when we get someone in to pick all the music. And tonight, my guest is Mark Doherty, actor, writer. He's mentioned guitar a few times as well. So there are various aspects to this man. But currently what he is focusing upon is his own play, Trad. We talked about it at the start of the programme. It's a play which had been around for a while, but it's back again. And tell me a bit more about it now at this stage, Mark, because you've got Erin Monaghan directing it.
Yeah.
Who's in it?
Seamus O'Rourke.
Uh-huh.
And Emmett Kerwin.
Uh-huh.
Play Da and the son. And then Claire Barrett, a brilliant comic actress, plays two roles.
She's Sal, as funny an actress as I've ever seen.
Ah, she's great, yeah.
She is so... I've seen her do lots of things over the years. She's very funny.
Ah, she is, you know, yeah, yeah.
And there's music in this.
There is, yeah. There's a guitar and fiddle, yeah.
And how do you handle that? How was that done?
There's a lovely guitarist, Tony Byrne, who played in the original production actually as well, and a fiddler, Andy Morrow, and they make beautiful noise with the dots provided by me dad again. But when I was writing it originally, I was listening to Martin Hayes and Dennis Cattle. I remember I had them on in the background a lot of the time, and when I was finished, I thought it would be lovely to have music, to have live music. Mm. As part of the show, and I gave the play to me dad, and I think I remember just saying to him, Martin Hayes and Dennis Cattle sort of style, and he came up with the music for the show, which is just so appropriate and really beautiful as well. And when we were rehearsing originally, it came together, and it you know, we had it at a kind of a level. And then I remember my dad coming in with the music and the musicians coming in, and it just lifted the whole thing. This was the original production that Michael Murphy directed with Frankie McCafferty and Peter Gowan and David Pearce.
That's a good cast as well, isn't it?
Lads, yeah. We were so lucky. Yeah, I was thinking about it recently, actually. The great collaboration. You rarely... Well, I work a lot on my own, you know, but when a collaboration comes together and people are thinking along the same lines, it's amazing how something can grow and improve. It was on in Galway. It wasn't supposed to be on in a theatre. It was going to be on in a pub or something. And I remember thinking, that's grand, because I'll get away with this now. Not many people will see it, and it'll be fine. It'll be over, and I can say that I've done a play. That I've written a play. I'm serious.
Yeah, I know.
And then we got word that whatever was supposed to be in Druid Lane was cancelled, and we were moving into Druid Lane. And I remember my heart started beating, and I just went, but that means people are going to come and see it. And I was terrified, and I thought, that means reviewers are going to come, and somebody's going to write a review of it. And there's me found out for certain.
Well, in those circumstances, and I know that's a common experience for actors and writers and all sorts of people, the fear of being found out and not sure if they can do it, one thing. You know. Do you know why you wrote it then? Because if your initial idea was, I'm going to write this, but I'm slightly worried that somebody might see it.
Yeah.
You are creating something which needs a public for it to make any sense, really.
Yeah.
So do you know why you were writing a play? Because you could have sat at home writing songs for yourself, or writing poems, or painting pictures.
Yeah, I did that as well. But yeah. They were so bad. They were worse than Trad.
So why did you put yourself through that then?
I don't know. I don't know is the truth. Yeah. There's never been a plan.
Mm.
I found myself somewhere, and I liked it, so I stayed with it. But I never thought of myself as a playwright. I just, you know, I was doing a bit of acting, and then I got into a bit of stand-up. And then I happened to get a commission for a short radio piece, and I was going left and right and straight on and backwards.
Do you call yourself a playwright now?
No, I don't.
You don't?
No, no, no. But how could I stand there with Tom Murphy and say, oh, you're a playwright. I'm a playwright too. Or Conor McPherson or Marco Rowe or these guys. You know.
But that's being hard on yourself, because that's like saying I can't play guitar because Jimi Hendrix exists, you know, or I can't play saxophone because John Coltrane exists, you know. You're still a musician, just, but you know, you're just not as good as those guys. But that's all right.
Well, maybe.
But that's all right. Very few people are as good as those guys. In fact, nobody's as good as those guys.
Mm, mm. Maybe they have. At a particular time they had the confidence to do it, or they thought of themselves as artists and had a more of a singular vision that I never had.
Do you call yourself an artist?
No, I don't.
Do you think of yourself as one, even in private moments?
The very odd time, maybe there's a percentage of what I do that comes from somewhere that I don't understand, you know. But a lot of the time, I think it's just I find myself somewhere and think, right, how do I get out of this and pay the rent this month?
Yeah.
But no, the odd time I sit down and take a lot of time. It's hard to find time when you're a little bit older and with a family and rent and a kid going to school and you know, all that. It's hard to find the time, but sometimes I do find the time to sit down and think of something original and pursue it and follow it through. Then if you hear terms like artistry or vocation, even I don't know if I believe in that. I think it's just I found myself doing something and I liked it, and then I was at it, and I became known for it, or it was what I did, and now it's 30 years later and I feel it's too late to get out anyway, so so I'm still here.
You might as well stick with it at this point. What else would you be doing? Yeah. Your next choice is Eddie Daniels. Now tell me about Eddie Daniels. You picked a few people in the jazz bracket who weren't particularly well known.
Yeah, Eddie Daniels. Well, I was given a clarinet at the age of 21 or something. A friend of mine was going away and selling all his possessions. And he asked me, did I want a clarinet for 60 quid? So I said, yes, I do. So I took the clarinet and I started trying to learn that, or trying to play it. And then I was with a musician one time and I was asking him, who should I listen to regarding clarinet? And the usual names came out, Benny Goodman and people like this. And then he said, have you heard Eddie Daniels? You got to hear Eddie Daniels. So I found an Eddie Daniels CD and I was just blown away by what this man could do on the clarinet. He has all the facility to play whatever he wants. He's got he's a classical musician as well, and well known in classical circles. So he's got the chops, and he's a beautiful jazz feel as well. And I heard the sound he makes on a clarinet, and I was so excited by it. It was a new fella, and a contemporary. You know, he's still around, still playing beautifully. Speaking of duets, he's made a couple of beautiful duet albums with Roger Calloway, the pianist. Mm. Again, the two of them just second-guessing each other and throwing bits to each other backwards and forwards. And the level of communication and artistry is very high, you know. But Eddie Daniels, yeah, his sound, he just, he hovers above the music. It's an ethereal thing. It's a lovely noise.
Eddie Daniels and She Wrote. Eddie Daniels there, and She Wrote from an album called To Bird With Love. Your next musical choice is what, Mark? Where are we at here? Oh, Shirley Horn.
Yeah, I love Shirley Horn. She's a piano player, a beautiful swinging piano player, and a singer, yeah. And she really, she's one that really inhabits the songs that she sings and chooses them very carefully. I don't think she'd bother singing anything otherwise if she didn't feel that she could make it her own, you know. But when I discovered her, I was very, excited. I knew there was a lot of listening ahead. It was a portal into a new thing.
It's great when that happens.
It's not that easy being green.
Shirley Horn, It's Not Easy Being Green. The choice of Mark Doherty is with me tonight in studio. Mark, you're talking about stand-up there. Obviously, your brother's still out on the road doing his very unique...
Yeah, he's doing all right.
He's doing all right.
O'Doherty.
We're not going through that again.
Yeah.
But in your case, how did you find stand-up? Because it seems, I guess, you know, anybody who's ever been in a theatre would look at a stand-up, and if they've any sense at all, they might think, that must be the toughest gig in the world.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, even a lot of actors say stand-up is the most frightening thing, and they're doing something that may not be a million miles away, you know, but it terrifies actors, a lot of actors that I've spoken to.
I mean, it doesn't take much to imagine what it must be like to make the first joke and dead silence. That must be awful.
Yeah, yeah, that's happened, yeah. It is awful, yeah. It's the most immediate response that you get to something that you produce and put out there. Yeah. You're standing in front of people and you're saying to them, I think this is funny, check this. And when they start back at you and go, no, you've made a mistake, that's not funny. It's very lonely, yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, you'd have a certain order, you'd have a set list, and then you might bring forward a couple of your killer gags that never fail you to try and get them on side, and the next one fails. And then the next one, and you realise, I have very little left and I have another 28 minutes to kill. It can be lonely, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But it doesn't happen that often. You know, if you're a stand-up, then you get good and you get better and you learn to deal with that and you have more material that you can mess around with and you get through those moments.
But this is getting good and getting better on the stage with people looking at you. Is there any way you can prepare for this? I mean, did you just, again, you mentioned earlier, a lot of things just came your way and you did them. Well, your first stand-up gig was as a result of what?
Yeah, I was acting, I was just finished in school and I'd done a couple of shows. Again, I might be making up the order of this, but I think I'm right. I'd done a couple of theatre things and I saw, I knew a couple of fellas that were involved. I think I had met Barry Murphy, who was doing the Comedy Cellar, and a couple of those guys. And then people who were connected, another fellow called Brendan Dempsey, another comedian, he knew that I was acting and I met him one time and he said, would you come down and do something, do 5 minutes of stand-up? And I thought it would be a good challenge. I thought it would be interesting. So I put my name down for a little set. Yeah, I wanted to do a double act, I remember, in the first gig, and I was trying to convince an actor to do it with me. And he pulled out at the last minute. And we had this kind of double act thingy. So I went ahead and did the gig anyway on my own. And I played it like I was the straight man of a double act. So a lot of it was about jokes. And then I didn't have a punchline. But I would get on to the next piece. And it worked in some mad way. It kind of worked. And I remember it was upstairs in McDade's pub. Yeah. Tiny little room in McDade's pub to about 30 people.
And when you mentioned what it's like when it's not going well. When it's going well, what's that feeling like?
Well, that first gig went well, and I do still remember it. I think it's probably the highest I've ever been in my life. You know, people liked it and laughed, and the high that you get off it is really quite astonishing. And I went home, and I just stared at the clock, lying in the bed. Staring at the ceiling, replaying, going over lines and bits that worked and bits that didn't work, with me foot jigging. And then it was like 6:30 in the morning or 7:00 in the morning, and I was still there, too high to go to sleep. So there's moments like that maybe that encouraged me to give it another go as well.
Let's talk about the movies.
Mm.
Normally, actors will tell you that their first love is the stage, and that's where it's all about. And movies are kind of just, you know, extra. But you were involved in a couple of movies that were kind of important in an Irish context, certainly. You know.
Yeah.
And you know, what was your experience then of the movies? Was it a worthwhile experience for you being in movies?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Again, you're just playing a little part. You know, you don't really have any. As an actor, you don't have much control, or in the jobs that I get, you don't have a lot of control. So you again hope that you hope that everybody, that somebody has the bigger picture in mind, the director, and you hope that, you're going to be performing with people that you enjoy performing with, and you hope that you can be part of that collaboration and make it into a bigger thing.
And the fact that you're a writer, does that make it easier or harder?
Yeah. I often wonder, maybe people are less likely to cast you if you're a writer because they think you'll be judging the lines. I don't know.
Or changing
That's
them
my
all,
excuse
yeah.
for getting no work. No work. But then I had an experience where I wrote a film with me in it.
Yeah, and you wrote that as with Dylan Moran.
With Dylan Moran, yeah. And that was an interesting one. That was a difficult... it was difficult when you've written the words and you hear them very clearly in one way and you know how the jokes can work. It's can be difficult then to pass it on and give it to a director and just hope that he sees it in the same way and has the same comedy bones and will cut it where you think it needs to be cut and will serve it like that. Yeah, yeah.
And would there be a lot of... I mean, you can't tell tales out of school, I guess, but, you know, you're filming a scene and are you stepping out of character to say, oh, hold on a minute, no, wait, that's not the way that's supposed
to
be.
Yeah, well, I wrote it with Dylan Moran in mind, so I was very aware that he would bring something very particular and probably better than a lot of the lines. He would come up with lines spontaneously that would be better than lines that I'd spent weeks writing, you know, so you have to be open to that as well, so...
Your next choice is Stan Getz. Was Stan Getz a familiar sound in your household?
Yeah, I know that my dad would. He'd be among my dad's favourite tenor sax players, I think. Yeah, yeah. But I think he might be my favourite of them all. Just his sound and his ideas. He just seems to have an endless flow of ideas. You get the feeling that he could blow 40 choruses on any song and not run out of ideas or repeat himself. But his sound is just his sound. Yeah, he's warm and cold when he needs to be and takes a song and plays the lyric on the tenor saxophone, I think.
Stan Getz.
If I only had a brain.
And that's Abby Lincoln there, If I Only Had a Brain. And before that, Stan Getz. And a track called Her from an album called Focus. Now, tell me, first of all, Mark, and Mark Doherty's with me tonight picking all the music, that Stan Getz album, Focus, with the string arrangements and so on, but it's not as straightforward as that because you were explaining that the arrangements were done.
I understand the arrangements were done and recorded, by Eddie Sutter. And then he wanted Stan Getz to come in. That was the... That was the idea, that Stan Getz would come in and improvise over it and create kind of spontaneous melodies over the top of it. That was the plan.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
I think it's very beautiful, yeah. There was a little story. I love a little story behind the music as well, but I read a biography of Stan Getz and they said that his mother died 2 weeks before the recording session, I think. And it sounded, the biographer, however he put it, but Stan was on the lash and hadn't played at all, hadn't picked up his instrument and came into the studio in a bit of a state and might have had a scotch and a few headache tablets and then listened to the strings a few times and then just came in and created these melodies over the top. Maybe there was some discussion around it or maybe there was some dots written on a matchbox, you know, but... But this is a spontaneous composition at its best, you know.
Then that Abby Lincoln song. You don't hear Abby Lincoln that often, you know, because she's kind of an ornery kind of a singer sometimes, you know.
Yeah, yeah, she's quite particular. I do like her. Again, she's got a jazz feel, you know. This you could give that song to somebody else, and they will sing it. But she invests something very unique and particular in individual into the lyric. And of course, I love the lyric as well.
Well, you know, Mark, that the jazz music, because of your dad and the people that your dad would have played with over the years and so on, the music you've listened to, it's a kind of a way of life as well, and it's a sort of philosophy, you know, of art and a philosophy of creation and all the rest of it. Do you think you've taken any of that side of your upbringing, the jazz background, into everything else that you do? Does it have any bearing on being a stand-up or being an actor or being a performer?
I don't know. Maybe it was easier for me to get started, or it wasn't such a shock, or it hasn't been such a shock each time I change direction to my parents. You know, they just go, "Oh well, that's
Miles Davis.
That's what he wants to do. do what you're happy doing."
But you're being exposed to a very, very high level of facility for a start, musicianship, but also creativity and imagination. And application. That's at a very, very high level. I mean, if you admire what Stan Getz has just done there, if you apply the same bar to your own performance, you know, you'd be aiming quite high.
Yeah, it leaves you very disappointed a lot of the time. Very disappointed with yourself. Yeah. It's a funny thing that I don't know. Like I said earlier, I think I don't know how much of it is me and how much of it is in my DNA about kind of expecting nothing. Ardal O'Hanlon used to have a line that I'm going to paraphrase and make a dog's dinner out of, but something like always expect a slap in the face, and if you only get a kick in the arse, then it's a bonus. I think I've got a lot of that where. I just can't, if anything is successful, I just can't believe it. I can't believe me luck. Do you know what I mean? And again, I'm not trying to be modest. It's just something, I don't expect people to like things a lot of the time. And if they do, I think not only have I got away with that, but somebody likes it. It's brilliant.
And some of those jazz guys that we're talking about, particularly the giants.
Yeah.
They didn't seem to be lacking in confidence in any way at all. Quite the opposite. You know, a lot of them seem to be very, very sure of what they were at. And we don't care whether you like it or not. This is it.
Yeah.
This is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know that line of Miles Davis where he said, "People don't come to hear me play, they come to watch me think."
Ooh.
I mean, that takes some nerve to say something like that. You better be good after that. Next choice is, Eddie Louis. I've never pronounced his name. He was a French musician, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Eddie Louis or Eddie Louis.
Yeah.
He was French, Hammond player.
Yeah, Hammond organ. Yeah, I always loved the sound of the organ. One of the first records in my dad's collection that I liked was George Benson playing with Brother Jack McDuff. Yeah. Just really funky church music, and. Then I've heard a few times Hammond organ and piano together, and it's a beautiful combination.
And a strange idea, in a way.
Yeah, it sounds all wrong, doesn't it? Yeah. And both big chordal instruments that you think will be bumping into each other all the time. But again, when you have the sensitivity and intelligence that that these artists have, then that doesn't happen so much.
And the piano player is Michel Petrucciani?
Yeah.
He's a marvel, really.
Yeah. A guy who was in an awful lot of pain for a lot of his life, I think, as well.
I'm not sure the name of the condition that he had.
I don't know either, no. But his growth was severely stunted. Yeah. And, in concerts, you see, he's carried out sometimes, even helped up onto a piano stool. But then the music he starts making, it's quite beautiful. I saw a documentary on him, too. I believe he was in pain a lot of the time. And he said the only time that he forgot was when he was at the piano, when he was playing. But he plays here with Eddie Louis,
This is called Rashid. Doherty is with me in studio tonight picking all the music, and that Eddie Louis and Michel Petrucciani Conference de Presse is the album, the track Rashid. Mark, it is kind of odd to hear the organ and the piano together. And when you mentioned it first, I thought, I'm not sure this is going to work, but it works really well.
Oh, yeah, I think it does, yeah. But they're both big chordal instruments, though, that I think, again, it just takes great players to listen and stay out of the way. And, you know, Bill Evans and Jim Hall playing together, or even like me dad and Louis, and I remember me dad talking about staying out of the way when doing duets with Louis. You know, you've got two massive instruments that are chordal as well as everything else. Mm. So the trick, or it takes some intelligence to stay out of the way and just accompany correctly and sympathetically, you know.
Well, the best jazz musicians are sensitive. Musically, anyway. I don't know, they're not all sensitive souls, but they're sensitive musically. We want to get another couple of tracks in before we go, so let's just move ahead, Mark, to Mark Murphy. And again, you've picked people who aren't all that well known, although you'll find them on lots of compilations to this day. You'll find them on a lot of cool, hip, funk, jazz kind of compilations too, mod jazz compilations even.
Yeah.
I remember seeing him in Dublin, actually. He came and he performed.
Yeah. I saw him in, do you remember, it was Reinhardt's.
Reinhardt's, that's
when
I saw
him.
Yeah. And it was kind of strange.
Mm.
Incredible voice.
Mm.
But he does that kind of singing, that kind, particular kind of jazz singing, that is certainly a minority sport, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know about the track you're about to play, but he does a lot of, what's it called? It's like the John Hendricks kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not scat as such.
It's not scat. That's why I'm trying to
playing wildly with the lyric and the melody.
Vocalese, is that right?
Vocalese, yeah. Well, Mark Murphy for me is the best, and then he's influenced guys like Kurt Elling and people like that.
Yeah.
But Mark Murphy, and he always stayed true to the music, as far as I know. When other guys were recording a lot of rock and roll, and he stayed with the Great American Songbook and the music that he loved and believed in. So no doubt he paid for it and moved record labels and was thrown around the place a bit. But another proper artist again.
And what do you want to play from Mark Murphy?
This is a song called Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. And he recorded it in about 2007, I think. So it's a mature voice. Compared to how he sang in the 50s and 60s, but
Mark Murphy.
Someone told someone, and someone told you. But they wouldn't hurt you, not much.
And that's Mark Murphy there, the choice of Mark Doherty and Mark Murphy's version of Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. And you never will. Mark, just before we go, and we mentioned the dates for Trad again before we go, what are you at the moment mostly, having just told us you've, over your career, moved back and forth, zigzagged?
The last few years, it's been movies. Yeah, trying to write movies.
That's a thankless task, isn't it? Writing
once again,
movies.
I've backed the wrong horse. Yeah, just as movies aren't being made anymore.
Yeah.
But no, I've written. I've probably written about 10 movies or.
Really?
So that's it. I've been working on a very beautiful thing. The last year, there's a book called At Swim Two Boys. Do you know that one? Not At Swim Two Boys.
Yeah.
At Swim Two Boys by Jamie O'Neill. Mm-hmm. And it's two young lads who fall in love. It's 1916. The book takes place over the course of a year, 1915 to 1916. And these two boys make a pact. It's set all around South Dublin and Dunleary. And they make a pact to swim from the 40-foot to Muglin's Rocks a year hence, which is coincidentally Easter Sunday, 1916. So you've got this beautiful merging of the boys' story and kind of searching for identity and Ireland kind of finding itself and becoming independent around the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful thing. It really is a proper work of art. So I'm trying to write a screenplay. I've just finished a draft of a screenplay that...
So when you, I mean, that's quite a lot of writing. But of course, anybody knows anything about trying to get a movie off the ground. You write this script and that script might never see the light of day, or indeed it might in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, you know. Can you, how are you at that side of it? I mean, the writing you can do, you do that at home. But after that, flogging the thing seems to be a real nightmare.
Yeah, well, it's usually out of my hands at that stage. It hasn't...
Of course,
I haven't been responsible for
flogging. You've got an agent and everything.
I have an agent, who'd do that, Or in this case, somebody came to me and asked me to do an adaptation of it. So, I do what I can do, and then after that, hope that there's some kind of life for it. In this case, it would probably be quite expensive because it's 1916, so immediately it's a period piece and it's going to be a few million quid to make it, you know. But it's such a beautiful story and so beautifully written by Jamie O'Neill, that I'd have some hope for it.
Well, good luck with all that. And Trad, which we were talking about earlier, which is the play that you have written, opens in Cork on this Tuesday, actually.
The 21st, I'm going to be down. I'm coming down. I think there's a question-answer thingy afterwards. So
Is it at the Everyman, is it?
That's the Everyman, yeah.
And you're going to do a Q&A as well.
Yeah.
And that play, just to remind everybody again, Emmett Kerwin's in it.
Emmett Kerwin, Seamus O'Rourke and Clare Barrett.
Directed by
a great actor that I'm sure, who you've had on here previously, Aaron Monaghan.
A talented man.
Yeah.
With a strange fondness for Garth Brooks. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
There's always a catch, isn't there?
Yeah, I heard that on the when I was listening to your show, and I had to switch off all.
Yeah, it was a strange moment, all right.
Yeah.
But anyway, your last.
People always let you down.
Your last track, your last choice, and we're going back to your dad here, Jim Doherty.
This is from Spondance.
Spondance. Is Louis on this too?
Yes, he is. Yeah. This was, my dad conceived it as a jazz ballet, he called it. He had great plans. It's never been produced as a ballet, but this was music that he recorded in 1986, I think, over in LA. And Jim had an association with Bobby Shue, a great trumpeter from over there. Bobby Shue was over playing at some festival here and they got on mightily. And I think Bobby ended up organizing the LA end of it, and he booked great session musicians and jazzers, and Jim brought Louis over as well as a featured soloist, and an album called Spondance. It really is a beautiful, it's not a big band, it's an 8-piece, I think, is it? But there's great beautiful writing.
8-piece,
and Louis really I don't know, I think Louis at his best as well. Just mercurial, and his tone is so beautiful, and his ideas, and he floats around the music. Yeah.
And this is called When Two People Meet.
Yeah.
Mark Doherty, thanks a million for coming in, picking the tracks. Pleasure.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.